From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the October edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we bring you bomb wrens being transported back in time when they saw Hut 11 restored to its wartime atmosphere, with a new exhibition all about their work. We'll also get an update on the rest of the restoration with the architect Janie Price. We bring you a chat from Hut 8, with the distinguished actor Simon Callow, whose university tutor in the 60s turned out to have been an influential codebreaker. Plus, there are some prestigious new events this autumn, featuring a team of top speakers. Whether you know him as a fine Shakespearean thespian, the one who died in Four Weddings and a Funeral, or even the professor from Ace Ventura Pet Detective 2, Simon Callow has a long and distinguished CV on the stage and screen. BBC Daily Politics asked him to make an authored film about Russia's anti-gay laws, and he chose to come to Bletchley Park to make the point that prosecution for being gay is within living memory in the UK. While filming in Alan Turing's office in Hut 8, he told me about his university tutor, who held a surprising secret.
We're making a very, very short film for the programme called The Week, to comment on the situation in Russia for gay people. Obviously, the question is whether one should protest at the Winter Olympics or make some other kind of gesture. And we had the idea that Alan Turing was a very interesting example of someone who lived in a society in which homosexual rights were non-existent. He was one of the great figures of the Second World War. He was a code breaker, perhaps the most brilliant of them all, a genius, mathematical genius, and saved innumerable lives. But in 1952, he was arrested for having sexual contact with another man and threatened with prison, and he opted instead to be chemically castrated with all sorts of terrible effects on his body. And 2 years later, he committed suicide. So we're saying, you know, this was England only 60 years ago.
It's incredible the leaps and bounds that have been made in one generation,
very,
two
very
generations.
Quick. Very, very quick, but not everywhere. That's the point. And in Russia, things seem to be going backwards, which is terrifying, because 10 years ago when I was in Moscow, there was absolutely no problem at all. Everybody was looking forward to a considerably more liberal dispensation with regard to sexual and every other kind of minority. And it turned out to be absolutely a false dawn, you know. It's a very scary situation.
You have heard of Turing before and already done some research, because I must gather you were almost involved in a project a few years ago.
Well, I do know quite a lot about Turing because I was going to direct a film about him. Joseph Fiennes was going to play the character of Turing. So I did indeed discover. I knew a little bit more about him anyway, because he's a very well-known figure as a representative figure, especially in terms of what happened to him as a gay man. And that there was a West End play with Derek Jacobi 20 years ago called Breaking the Code, and there's been a lot about Turing, so I certainly knew about him. And it is one of the most terrible and poignant stories, because he was a very sweet man in so many ways, somewhat otherworldly, as many mathematical geniuses are. So it's fascinating to see where he worked and how he worked and so on. But I have another more personal connection, in a way, because I went to university in Belfast in 1968. My tutor in the subject of the history and philosophy of science was a man called John Herivel, J.C. Herivel. And Herivel was one of the code breakers. In fact, he was responsible for one of the most useful discoveries in the code breaking. But I knew nothing about it at the time. He said nothing about it. Nobody did say anything about it in those days, and really not almost to the end of his life. Then he wrote a book which he called the Herivel Exception, which is one of the names by which what he discovered was known.
I think we call it the Herivel Tip. It's quite widely known as. And it was a key sort of observation about human nature and its relationship with technology. When you think about the way that technology is developed now, this iPhone, for example, that I'm recording you on, it's key, isn't it, to think about how human nature links in with how you're going to use things.
Well, that was the great thing about John Herivel's observation, was that it wasn't actually a mathematical observation at all. It was just an intuitive leap, which, of course, many scientific discoveries are based on. But he applied common sense in a kind of way to the situation.
What must it have been like for you to learn about this man who'd been an authority figure, been quite important in your university years, and then to find out that he'd done what he'd done during the war? I mean, I suppose there are a lot of people who you didn't know what they did during the war because there were good reasons for that, but it must have been quite something to read his autobiography.
Well, yes, it was actually when he died. He died 2 years ago that it came out. I hadn't heard of it. I didn't even know he'd published a book. I was absolutely astonished because I often wondered what happened to him. He was a wonderful teacher in the old-fashioned way. You know, during his tutorials, he used to make us tea and toast crumpets by the fire. And a very profound thinker, in fact, but very unexpected in his approaches and in his discussions. But there was no sense at all that he'd done anything extraordinary with his life.
You couldn't guess and put it away. And so many, they don't even talk about it now.
No, I know. Well, that's, of course, his generation, you know. They didn't kiss and tell.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
There are some prestigious new events at Bletchley Park this autumn. At Decoding Bletchley Park on Saturday the 26th of October, two top authors, Sinclair Mackay and Elisa Seagrave, will talk about how they researched and wrote their latest books. Codebreakers Legacy on the 9th of November will follow on from last year's successful Turing Education Day, with talks from Professor Jack Copeland, Professor Barry Cooper, Dr. Joel Greenberg and author Michael Smith. They will look at the achievements of the Codebreakers, including lesser-known characters such as Gordon Welchman and John Tiltman. Revelations and discoveries are coming thick and fast now as the £8 million Heritage Lottery-funded restoration of Bletchley Park progresses. Work is continuing on what builders and architects call the shell and core of Wooden Huts 3 and 6 and the concrete and brick Block C. I caught a quick update with architect Janie Price of Kennedy O'Callaghan inside Hut 6, where the floorboards are being assessed one by one.
We're now in Hut 6, and we're in a room that has been done as a sample so that we can take a look at whether we're happy with it before we proceed with the rest of the rooms. So we've taken out the rotten floor joists and the rotten floorboards and put in new joists and new boards. In the rest of the rooms, we're hoping to recycle boards which are taken from Fawley Court in Henley, which have been donated to us. And we've had a look at their boards, and they're getting listed building consent to have their wartime huts removed. And if they get that and they're able to take them out and the timing works, we're going to use their boards. But in the meantime, we've had to crack on. So in here, this particular room, this is the northwest room, we've got the new boards. And we've kept as much of the original plasterboard as possible with a view to taking a look and seeing if it's going to look too far gone, whether it's bowing too badly and whether we're going to possibly be able to get rid of all that flaking paint so it won't fall on visitors. So we need to take a view. We've got one or two new panels that have been put in and we just want to take a view on whether it's going to look acceptable to have the new and the old next to each other and whether we can keep as much of the original or whether it's just going to be accepted that it's gone too far and that it's not salvageable.
That's the balance throughout this project, isn't it? Is what's salvageable and what...
Absolutely, we're trying to keep as much as we can, but things like plasterboard, once they've decayed, the trouble is they've got mould growth on the outside, they've got lots of flaky paint on the inside. Some of them have been painted with gloss paint, which is quite difficult to get off, and it's flaking very badly. So I think we're just looking at each one in turn, and we're going to salvage as much as we possibly can. And we're putting back anything that we can, so if it needs to come off to repair anything behind it, it gets set aside, we look at it, see what the condition's like and put it back if we possibly can.
There's a big division along one side of the corridor versus the other with the state of the floor, isn't there?
That's right. The whole of the west side of the building's completely decayed, the reason being the ground level externally has been raised up. So when the tarmac was put down and the road was put down, it was too high. And so it's higher than we need. We need to get it down 300 millimetres below the sole plate, below the damp proof course. So until that's done, water's just pouring in, decaying the whole of the sole plate and getting in, decaying all of the joists. So we've got a disparity. The rest of the building is in a far better state and some of it's perfect and hardly touched, apart from a few joists where we found that the sapwood was too high a content, so the original joinery wasn't good enough. But mostly the floorboards were all graded and stamped as being properly graded when they were built. So they were selected for being quite high quality. So we don't have too many problems in the areas where we haven't had this severe water ingress. The other problem is that we've had no rainwater pipes working, gutters working for years and years. So water's just been seeping into the walls and being completely rotting the wall plates.
Okay. It's a double whammy. So when was the road put in then?
I think that it was originally a path. So early on, the pathway that was part of the Leon estate actually ran directly under this hut.
Mm.
And so when this hut was built, the road would have been put to the west. But I think originally it would have been a concrete road, and it's been bitumened on top, so the level's just gradually come up and up and up.
Oh, I see. At every point throughout this, whatever's been done to these buildings and then to the roads surrounding them, nobody could ever have imagined now in 2013 being trying to salvage what's left
Open
it up to the public.
So. These huts were only put up as temporary structures, and so they probably would have expected them to be taken down after the war. And it's extraordinary they've lasted as well as they have.
One element of this huge project that is finished and ready for visitors is the newly restored Hut 11. The Wrens, who operated bomb machines in Hut 11, called it the hellhole. It was hot, noisy and hard work on round-the-clock shifts. Thanks to a very generous legacy of £250,000, the Trust has been able to restore this building to its wartime atmosphere, complete with a dirty ceiling, and an exhibition all about the work of the Wrens. The legacy has also paid for the design of the restoration of Hut 11A next door. Friends of Bletchley Park were invited to a private first viewing of the new exhibition, the first of many in the coming months. Podcast producer Mark Cotton was there, and I picked the story up at the grand opening the following morning.
Girls, only 4 hours to go before supper. It has been a very long day, but you must not lose your concentration at any cost.
Hey, Amy, tea's up. Gordon Bennett, my eyes ache. These lights are so flicky. I don't know what's worse. The lights, the noise, the heat, or smelling of engine oil from morning till night. Now for a fine cup of Maserati tea, made even more delicious and, orange. With the addition of tinned milk. Still, maybe it will keep me going for the next 4 hours.
Good evening and welcome to Bletchley Park. I'm Ian Standen. For those who don't know me, I'm the Chief Executive of Bletchley Park, and it's a great privilege and pleasure to welcome you here this evening. For this sneak preview of Hut 11. Hut 11 will be opening to the public tomorrow, and you've got a chance here to see it before everybody else does and see what we've actually done with it. So, Hut 11, it was a bit scruffy. It had some old bomb machines from the film Enigma. It had scruffy painting, scruffy chairs, and there was no interpretation. There was nothing there to explain its purpose, its importance. We relied on our guides to take people through, and that created us a bottleneck because we're trying to shuffle through at busy times 50 people every 15 minutes or so. So it wasn't really conducive to providing a good visitor experience. So we decided that we ought to go out and fundraise to develop this, and indeed Hut 11A, which sits behind it, a much bigger structure, to increase interpretation and make it better for our visitors. And now's perhaps a good time to talk about the fundraising. It was a great effort. We've got a newly formed fundraising team who went out and did this, and they did a hell of a lot of applications to various places. And we also managed to bring in, which was very welcome, a legacy from a lady who used to work here in the Second World War, went on to work for GCHQ, and we got a legacy donation from her out of her estate, which has helped to fund this and start the work on Hut 11A. And 11A, which we'll be opening next year, which is behind this, will complement 11. 11 is a story of how the people who operated the bombs worked, what they did, a bit about how they lived, how they were trained, and the jobs they did. What 11A will do, we'll talk about the bomb machine itself, how it was invented, what it was invented to do, how it actually operated, and stick it in the context of that. That's all I'm going to say, and what I will do, therefore, is hand over to Ruth Bourne here, who actually operated bombs during the Second World War.
Thank you. Well, I was asked to talk about, just to give you a rough idea of what it was like to be a bomb operator. Have you all heard the bombs going round?
Yeah.
Well, if you have, you They make quite a lot of noise, and if you multiply that by anything up to a dozen, that would be the first thing that would hit you. The noise of these bombs clicking round when you went into this enormous room, and also you would have the smell of the oil, and you would also have not very much proper daylight, because there were wartime fluorescent lights, and they flickered. They were quite bright, although in the middle of the night they seemed to take on a sort of greenish hue, as often the bomb operators did too, about 4 o'clock in the morning. However, you went in and you took over from whoever was operating your bomb, and from then on it was a pretty active time, because the bombs took 15 minutes to do a run. During this time, you were tweezing out the drums that had been taken off the machine. You had to take off usually at least 36 drums every 15 minutes, and you put them on the table behind you and hastily put on a fresh row of drums and set it going again, and off they went, clickety-click, and you had to tweeze these. And they put the fear of the Lord into you if you didn't do it properly, because there were lots of these little wire brushes with 19 strands in each. They all had to be tweezed out so that they didn't touch one another. And they also had to be put on properly to the bomb machine when they were ready to be put on, because they had to make perfect contact with the little commutators that were on the machine itself. And the whole bomb could go wrong if those wires were not properly tweezed. So you were tweezing away. At the same time, if your bomb stopped, you had to write down the information that was offered to you on a little piece of paper. You rushed through to the back of the bigger bomb bay and you put it through the hatch to your checker, who would check the stop. Then you would run back in case the machine stopped again. And when all that was done, you had a little logbook on the table and you had to write down the wheel orders, what had been run, and the number of stops and any remarks. Not necessarily polite, but nevertheless, we tried our best. And that was more or less the frenetic time. You did get half an hour off to go and rush out, go past the guards, run to the canteen, get your meal, and run back within the half hour so that your checker could do the same. And you and your checker always worked as a pair to plug up the plugs at the back. And when you'd plug them up properly, it looked a little bit like Spaghetti Junction, because they're all hither and thither, and you'll see that when you see the real bombs at the back. But it all worked out well in the end. And the only exciting bit, really, was if you were lucky enough and you got the wheel orders that gave you the right answer, then you had a little bit of a thrill that the job was up, but they never told you what was in it. And I've had to wait till now to find out.
This war has been going on for so long that it seems the natural state of affairs. Peace, when it comes, will take a bit of getting used to.
My maiden name, Josephine Ross, R-O-S-S. I'm now Josephine Chambers on your records. This was brilliant. My mother was Hut 3, so this is a bit different to me. But my father had been in the army. He was injured in training, so his regiment went off without him. He was sent into military intelligence and came here. And then, I'm not sure how long after, but it was March 42. He was at the door to the old dining room, letting a lot of wrens and other ladies past. And my mother, who was very pretty, in the Foreign Office, Hut 3, arrived. And he said, let's go into lunch together. And they were engaged 2 weeks later. And they got married 6 months later.
Lovely.
And, of course, like everybody here, they never talked about it, so my brother and I grew up knowing nothing. I was a Bletchley baby. I hasten to say, years later, they waited to start their family until after the war. My brother is older than me. But that meeting in 1942 at the dining room door...
That's lovely.
..what brought me about. But it's wonderful what you're doing with it all. You're really doing a super job. I've got all my mother's diaries, so I'm going to talk to your archive. Literally every single day.
What were your parents' names?
He was Harry Ross. He was a captain in the intelligence corps, working on, I'm afraid, German police reports, which I think were pretty... all those Gestapo reports about what's going on in the concentration camps. He worked with Major Tester and Colonel Tiltman... and that group. My mother was Hut 3 because she was a languages graduate at Sheffield University. She'd read French and German. But I don't think they even talked to each other. I mean, separate departments, I think, were kept very compartmentalised, weren't they? So they couldn't, even if they wanted to, leak any information.
Well, really lovely story. And so lovely to have you
here.
Listen to them all. Clickety-click. All those wheels whirling round, and you're just recording the stops. It's like churning blooming butter on a hot day. Eventually, though, the butter will come and the messages can be decoded and lots of lives will be saved. If not, probably someone's had it.
So we've got Vicky Walpole, Director of Learning and Collections from the Bletchley Park Trust, and Steve Lumby, the Event Communications Senior Exhibition Designer. Is that right?
Something like that.
Yes. So tell me how the idea came about for what you've ended up doing.
The idea came about through the need to record the efforts of the people that worked the bombs, the Wrens, and the efforts they made in making it. It's all about what they did. We've got a
good stop on. Because you can fall into the trap in telling the story of Bletchley Park and to telling it in a very technical way and just talking about machines and processes, but that discounts the 10,000 or so people that worked here and what they went through.
I think it's very important that we tell the people side of the stories here at Bletchley Park, because without the people, the machines would have meant nothing. So, especially the Wrens, because there were so many Wrens working on bombs around the country, and they're sort of unsung in some respects. We all know about the code breakers, and there were many cogs in a great big wheel, and we have to make sure we tell all of them stories.
There's a rich archive in the Oral History Project, isn't there? So what was it like sort of looking at all that to draw on?
That was an absolute bonus. It's very rare that you do get that kind of resource designing museums.
It must have been quite hard to pick what you would choose out of it.
We've been interviewing the veterans so much lately, and we have quite a large library now of veterans' interviews and memories. It's brilliant. When you start doing a project like this and you start reading the transcripts or you're listening to the interviews, it's brilliant because, you know, they come up with all different stories and different things. And although this is mainly about the work on the bombs, we have put in some information about where they lived and some out-of-work activity, because they were people, and they were young ladies, and they weren't dissimilar to young ladies today, and that's quite relevant to the visitors.
And tell me about the interactives.
Again, difficulty with the interactives is to know how difficult to make them, because it was obviously very difficult for the Wrens, but how difficult do you make it for the visitor?
Go on, Vicky, show me how to do this one.
Okay, so this interactive is about plugging up at the back of the bomb. So you have a time limit, because we wanted to make it more difficult, and you have to plug up six different parts of a menu within the time. If you do it correctly, you get a well done, you've finished your first Wrens training. If you don't, they all pop out and you have to try again.
It's magnetic, isn't it? It's funky. Yes. Go on, give it a go then.
Okay, ready?
Oh, that one doesn't like it. So you've got the corresponding letters, it tells you with the line between them, and you've got to match them up. Oh, try again. You have not finished your first Wrens training.
No, I've failed, I'm afraid.
Do you think maybe you just wouldn't do during the war?
I told you I would never have made a Wren.
Oh, Vicky.
Well, I've had six goes and I still haven't got it right, so I don't know what I'm doing wrong.
Maybe when we get some children in, they'll get it.
Yay! She's done it. I didn't do it, Steve.
Well done, Steve.
That appeal was wrong.
1941, I came, and I can't remember how long I was actually here.
Right.
Before Wavendon House opened up, and a lot of us were sent there.
Near Wavendon. What happened there?
Well, we lived in the beautiful house, and they built a hut in the grounds.
Yeah.
On every watch, we just went over to the hut, did the work, the same work as here, and back to sleep and eat in this beautiful house.
Yeah.
Bletchley Park was quite spread out in some ways. There were the buildings.
The outstations, yeah. Sound like, yeah. And what was it like working on the bombs?
Horrible.
Why?
Well, they were machinery, which I don't think we women were used to. Dame Vera Lawton Matthews, who was the director of Wren's, said when she heard that when her Wren's were to be put on the bombs, I don't think I want my girls working on machinery, I think is what she said. They took no notice. She was the sister of, who was the actor?
Charles Lawton.
Charles Lawton. She was his sister. She looked like him too.
Really?
Big. She was lovely. When I joined the Wrens, I thought I'll be, posted somewhere by the sea and meet a sailor. And it ended up in the middle of Buckinghamshire.
What was Buckinghamshire like in 1941?
Lovely country, Buckinghamshire, yes.
A bit different now. Milton Keynes has been splattered over.
Yes, I imagine so.
What did you do with your time off?
Oh, we used to walk through to the Watling Street. We hitched to London.
No, really?
As quickly as we could get to London.
And what did you do when you get to London?
Oh, don't ask us. I can't remember. Well, I lived beyond London, so I probably went home, a lot.
And what sense did you have of the importance of the work you were doing?
I don't think we realised then how important it was.
Yeah.
Because, we didn't really know what we were doing. I mean, we did what we were told, but I think we didn't realise what it was all about and the importance of it. And, I mean, we just didn't talk about it.
How did you interpret the fact that they said, keep this a secret, don't talk to anybody? What did that mean to you?
Well, I don't think you wanted to talk about your work anyway. And as for knowing people in other huts, just didn't meet other people. But then that was early, don't forget. That was October 41, I think, when I came. And that was quite early on. Whereas later, I think we were told more about what we were doing. And I wouldn't really want to come here again to work, to do the work.
Well, thank you for coming today.
Well, thank you.
Oh! Looks like we've got some results. Hello, this is Greece. We've got a good stop on Athens. The letters are O, U, G and L. I've just got to wait now. I'm going to London on my next free weekend. Theatre, film, all cut price for service folk. I'm going to see Sid Field and hear Zoe Gale sing. I'm gonna get lit up when the lights go out in London.
Job up. Job up, girls. At last. Well done. Strip the machine down as fast as you can. You're moving on to the next menu.
Job up, Amy. Prayers answered. We got the right settings. Now, please, give it to them, lads.
By joining the Friends of Bletchley Park, you can be the first to see all of our new exhibitions as this enormous project comes to fruition. You'll also receive a glossy biannual magazine with exclusive interviews and features and a monthly e-newsletter, as well as being first in the queue for ticketed events. You can find details on the Bletchley Park website.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.